Thank you for listening to the Calgary Business Podcast. As host, I am uniquely placed to learn about the initiatives of small business owners, students, student founders, educators, EdTech founders, civic officials, nonprofit executives, healthcare executives, technology experts, money management experts, technology startup founders, and even oil and gas tech startups. These individuals have shared their stories both in person, before COVID, and remotely since March 2020, as the world continues to navigate the constantly changing COVID landscape. Out of 104 episodes recorded and released so far in 2021, I had the privilege of learning about the important work of MindFuel and their Founders Fundamentals program. Through a 9-week program, potential entrepreneurs from the Calgary community are provided with a forum to exchange ideas with one another around their potential or existing startup. MindFuel executives also invited business leaders from around the Calgary community to share their experiences, their insights, and their advice for these founders. Take the time to consider learning more about MindFuel and possibly contributing your time to help with their Founders Fundamentals program. Once again, thanks for listening to the Calgary Business Podcast. I invite you to subscribe to the podcast from whatever app you access your podcasts, including Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and even Amazon Music. I also invite you to leave a review. This will allow others to easily find the Calgary Business Podcast. Have a great day and stay safe. Good morning and welcome to Calgary Business Podcast. I'm your host, Alan Wozni. And for episode number 331, 7th of December, I'm going to say your first name and last name together, Dr. Moshe Pour. But you told me to call you Muhammad. So look, this is an exciting, in my view, it's the best podcast of the year. It won't be the last, but this software, tech is around us and I've seen some articles, but there's so much to unpack here today, but you're at the software engineering program. First, introduce yourself and then we'll deep dive into what you guys are doing up at Schulich.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here. Well, as you said, my name is Mohammed Moshepour. I'm a senior instructor at Schulich. I'm also the software engineering teaching chair and the director for the MEng in software engineering program. It's a very exciting time at Schulich, and in particular in our department at electrical and software engineering, which we changed the name recently, by the way. It used to be called electrical and computer engineering for years. So we recently changed to software. So again, it's a very exciting time for software engineering.
Yeah.
A lot of new faculty members and scholars have joined our team. I think about it over the last couple of years, 10 people have joined. A number of our graduates have risen from about 40 graduates to close to 300.
Wow.
And exciting new courses are being offered, and we work closely with the industry to try to offer more realistic and real world projects to our graduates. It's a very exciting time.
Let's talk about you rebranded. You're like Facebook, and you guys decided to change the name, and let's go with, I mean, how come you didn't just go with like soft or something simple like that? Where?
Right.
Maybe
right.
Just where?
Well, the name of the departments are usually very sort of traditional, right? So you have the Department of Computer Science and then Electrical Engineering. And we just wanted a name that reflects the software engineering faculty and students. There's actually a difference in the name of the degree. So if you get a degree in computer engineering versus software engineering, there's a bit of a distinction.
Oh, okay.
Now that distinction may differ from school to school. So frequently asked questions that I get is, what's the difference between computer science and software engineering?
That's one of my questions. That's literally my second question, and it's a go-to question. So on the table, please, Mohammed, just share that, because it's, I still don't understand it. Maybe you can shed some light on that.
So I have an interesting fun fact to share about that. I happen to have received both degrees from University of Calgary. So I graduated with a degree in computer science, a BSc, and then a BSc in software engineering. Now, there was a lot of courses that overlapped.
Yeah.
And that almost happened by accident. But it helped me take a lot of algorithm courses and a lot of fun courses from computer science. To talk about how computer science differs from software engineering, it's a long discussion. But in computer science, they look at the theory of computing as a whole.
Yeah. So you're talking Charles Babbage, going back to, you know, those early days.
Let's say Alan Turing, exactly.
Yeah, Turing courses are great.
Like I took, there's a course called CPSC 313 at the University of Calgary, and then a CPSC 413, which are pretty much algorithm focused. And I love taking those courses. So computer science is a very huge umbrella term. So you can argue that, and you know, of course, you know, maybe we could have some colleagues here, and then we could have a whole debate about this. I don't want to say
we should do that. We should have a panel. We got the computer science on one side, like if you go Geraldo Rivero style, and you got the software engineers, and you have in between some other, you know, some ruffians to hold them back.
Absolutely. So let me answer this question this way: if you were going to hire a software engineer.
Yeah.
You would get applicants from computer science graduates as well as software engineering graduates, and you end up hiring somebody who you think fits the bill. So a lot of times they get the same sort of jobs as well.
Sure.
But I believe it's just a way of looking at education in computing. And again, computer science is almost an umbrella term because it covers many, many things. Perhaps software engineering is one of the things that computer science has in common with engineering. Because in computing, in software engineering, we apply a lot of engineering principles, such as quality control and building and design to the building of software. So there are a lot of computer scientists who work in the area of software engineering, which is essentially how to build software well.
Yeah.
In our school, you have departments of electrical engineering and computer science. I believe that's the name of the department in MIT, if I'm not mistaken, or in some other schools. In our school, it just happened to be divided this way. Going through those programs, I appreciated the difference between the cultures in different departments, and they both have wonderful things to teach and wonderful areas that they focus on. And I personally benefited a lot from doing both, even though, I could have done fine with just having one of them. And I try to, when I teach, in my own teachings, look at the computer science side as well, and you know, which is more focused on, let's say, algorithm design and perhaps a bit of a mathematical side of programming. And I enjoy that quite a bit.
It's interesting because I want to share. I mean, there's several students from your faculty that have been on the podcast, and the recent one was with the Black Line. So the CTO of Black Line was on as well. So. Separately, but the students were on. I'm gonna refresh my memory here because now I've lost my train. But he was talking about the CTO. This has not happened to me. I want to share this because it's important, the thought. Greg Adam. So Craig Adam, CTO of Propra, and he talked a lot about structure and to your point about architecture, but. Craig talked about how he approaches problem solving vis-a-vis when he's, to solve a problem for coding. So he talked a lot about architecture and talked structure. And so, you know, I think you've hit the nail a little bit. So you got some theory and then you bring into how to frame and build something. Because you and I talked offline a little bit as well about how you approach new students. How do you approach it? Because they don't just come in coders. all the time. You've got students
That's right.
with varying backgrounds. So how do you approach That's that right. for someone who's never coded?
You know, sometimes when you want to teach some stuff, let's say algorithm design or just coding in general, it can be quite easy to teach that stuff, right? I mean, you teach syntax for, let's say, C++ or Java. This is how you define a variable. This is how you get the program to make decisions.
Yeah.
It's fairly straightforward. Then you go next and you try to talk about, let's say, algorithms. You say, okay, well, you know what? The most common algorithms people talk about is sorting. You know, how do you sort, let's say, an array? How do you sort the list? Well, it's easy enough to sort, you know, 5 or 10 things, but when you have thousands and millions and billions, then it becomes that much more difficult. And then searching and sorting are quite challenging. But even that, it's fairly straightforward. It's essentially mathematical how you sort of structure that together. But some stuff that software engineering deals with are a lot more difficult to teach. And it's because in a semester, you have 4 months. So software engineers deal with huge, huge systems and systems working with other systems. And over time, the needs that those systems are going to have. And that is a much bigger thing to teach in a 4 month, you know, period. So getting students to appreciate all the concepts that are required for, let's say, an experienced architect, it's tough. And you may not be able to get them to see all that, which is also fine because they're gonna go in their careers and see it. But you know, how do you prepare students to build scalable systems, which is to say systems that are going to handle a lot of load simultaneously. And, you know, build maintainable code and understand that what is maintainable code and what is not maintainable code, because any code will run, but then how maintainable is going to be. And that reminds me of an episode of Seinfeld where Kramer is cooking this huge feast. And he ends up messing it up, of course. And Jerry asks him what happened. And he says, well, Jerry says, didn't you read didn't you follow the recipe? And he says, well, the recipe was for 4 people. and I'm cooking for 200 people. So so that's sort of the issue, that it's very hard to teach how to build software for, let's say, millions of people and the software that's maintainable over time.
I just listened to a podcast with Reid Hoffman. So he's the co-founder of PayPal, co-founder of LinkedIn. And he was saying he was talking about AI. The question came about AI. How do you do this and how does it work? He said, here's a search back in the day when they did a search algorithm to search a word or keywords or whatever, you know, said it would take hundreds of lines of code or thousands of lines of code and 300 hours to get that. Today with AI, supplement that search. They could take a few, it's probably 30 hours or whatever. He's just giving a quick example. He said, so that AI is that, in my view, is that no code. So building, you only have 4 months. I guess, how do you focus versus there's a no code out there today, whatever it is, JavaScript, CSS, you can copy and paste and move forward very quickly, very rapidly. So I guess you have a dilemma because you've 4 months versus 4 years or whatever it is. How do you distinguish between, I need to teach them that 3,000 hours of code or 300 hours of code or 30 hours. How do you balance that?
Right. Excellent question. You know, I look at it this way. I think that in my mind, I divide the content into two parts, fundamental and applied. And I think that there is a fundamental knowledge that's required for software engineers, and they must have that. Right, they must know, for example, they need to know the basics of algorithms, they need to know the basics of object-oriented programming, functional programming, procedural programming, and they should be problem solvers. So that fundamental knowledge must be there. I think that's what universities actually do pretty well at, right? Like universities are good at building that fundamental knowledge. And the area that universities could step up a bit, in my view, is the applied learning and hands-on learning where, okay, well, I know how to code and I know how algorithms work. Let's try to build sort of real systems let's try to put in practice a real process in engineering. And that's the part that I'm really focused on as part of my chair activities. And then with regards to areas of specialty, you know, whether it's AI, VR, AR, you know, with regards to, let's say, back-end development, front-end development, I think that then students start to specialize a little bit in their future years. But I think that it's important that, for example, all our graduates have a background of strong fundamentals in AI.
I love this because the fundamentals, I mean, go back to hockey, right? I'll give you my example of a hockey playing. There was plenty of times where everyone wants to shoot the puck and take the stick and go. And I just remember back, no, we're going no sticks today because we need to learn the fundamentals of skating, circles. So I'm just giving you the hockey, those fundamentals are ideal because you're not going to do the penalty shot. You know, everybody wants to do a penalty shot, right? That's everybody wants to do that, whatever it is. Same basketball, the slam dunk. If you don't know the fundamentals, whatever that 30,000 hours or 30 hours, whatever it is, it doesn't matter because you know what? I thought it would be easy to do an hour of code. I'm just giving you another example. I thought it'd be very easy to do 100 days of free coding. But you know what? The copy and paste, it doesn't help for if I don't have that fundament. I don't have the fundamentals. It was very difficult when I got to the point where I had to do my own, the hover feature. I'm like, well, I don't have the fundamentals.
For sure. And I think that it's important to be able to conceptualize a problem, you know, for people who are too, keyboard happy and they're just, you know, they're just going to jump on keyboard and start writing code. It usually doesn't work out. You know, there's a software development has a whole process associated with it. And I think that if you learn the fundamentals, I always tell my students that there's sort of a logarithmic graph, essentially to this whole thing, or is that throughout your education, there's a point of time that you really need instructors. And then from that point on, you don't need instructors so much that you need coaches, right? So the role of the professor or teacher really should change to a role of a coach after a point of time. So let me use object-oriented programming as an example, which is one of my favorite topics, and I love teaching it. You start telling people what an object is and how objects should communicate. That part needs a lot of instructions, and you need to really understand how memory works and how, parallel execution, all of that works. And you need and a good instructor to really teach you all of that really, really helps. Then when you learn all of that, you start looking at design and then it starts to be a little bit more creative and you start to look at things like design patterns, much like architectural patterns, you know, open style kitchen, you know, what have you. You start to look at these patterns and that we have in object-oriented programming and having, at that point, I start to really change roles from being an instructor and just sort of lecture to more of a coach, where I put a problem up and I say, what do you think? What pattern can be applied to this? And that's where, you know, students need to be more creative and just apply that knowledge.
Brilliant. You know, because that's simple. I read an article recently, I think it was about in Stanford, the computer science engineering department. They were like, students, they asked them about the file, the store, where was it stored? And they're like, file storage and the file structure and all that, which is the root, you know, that I just think, because me, I go back to, it's second nature because I was at U of C when, you know, there were the dot matrix printers and all that. But how do you have that problem? Do you see that where they don't understand where the file storage is? It's just there.
Well, I think that, computers, computers are magic, right? I mean, you press something and it just works.
Restart. Just push restart. It'll work if you restart it.
Pretty much. And there is that. So, and they do everything for us. So it's, and also at the same time, they're so complicated. I mean, there's so much to know. So a lot of times it's just easiest to divide and conquer and say, okay, well, the computer is taking care of all of this for me. So I'm just going to worry about the part that I need to do. And I think it's reminiscing of mathematics. When I was in high school, I remember graphing calculators was just coming to become a thing. And I'm kind of dating myself now, but
I know what you're saying, because it's too graphic. Otherwise you have to do the XYZ, whatever it is.
It was like my sister and I are kind of, you know, she's a couple years younger than me, and basically I didn't have a graphic calculator, and then she had to go and buy one. And we drew everything by hand, whereas she would just draw it using her graphic calculator. And I thought that art learning was much better because we were able to just figure everything out. I mean, technology helps, but a lot of times technology, you know, why worry about things anymore? I mean, how good are you in finding addresses? Like if somebody gives you direction, I'm terrible, right? I'm horrible at it. And I think that I have stayed dumb in that area because of my GPS, because I don't need to think anymore. It just says,
you're right. You're absolutely right. But at the same time, I used to learn. And you know, you can learn from the London black cabs, right? They need to memorize. So that memory table, I used to learn a city or whenever I travel a lot, and by going for a run, you know, early morning when there's no traffic and I learned the streets that way versus relying upon the GPS. And I kind of, you know, visual. I mean, I remember listening to a podcast, a woman, she was talking about somewhere in Kenya or wherever in Africa. And she said, we only knew by the landmark, the hill or the big, you know, the big TV tower. That's still a big part of how people say they associate. When I was in the Middle East, like, there's a big roundabout, you turn right. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
You always go by the association because the maps weren't, the GPS was, the construction so quick and for things changed. The road, this road didn't exist. Literally, it would show a road and it was a roundabout, or vice versa, it was a roundabout.
For sure. And if you think about it, by that analogy, then I'm a mathematician, you know, you're a mathematician as long as I have my graphic calculator, or, you know, I can take you anywhere as long as I have my GPS. And if I don't have a GPS, or if I go, I was driving in Portugal, for example, where GPS wasn't as accurate and, you know, I had a lot of problems. Whereas if you build that instinct of finding direction, you can. So you got to really think about it in that way as an engineer. I mean, in software engineering, there are a lot of frameworks. So you got to ask yourself, do you really know what the computer does, or are you just using a framework? Are you just, you know, basically filling the slots and you really don't have any idea of what's going on? And really people who are really sort of, they make big changes in computing, they really know what's going on, right? They really know what's happening in memory. They really know what the algorithm is doing. They really know, parallel processing, how that's working, and they have a solid idea. And we hear that from industry leaders all the time too, that we just want people to really know stuff. And that's something that I try to exercise in my classes quite a bit. So for example, when we build a client server application, there's one assignment that I give them that I just basically ask them to build a client server application using socket. So they do socket programming, and then I get them to do their own MVC framework, model MEC, view controller.
MEC being what?
Model view controller. So that's how you divide your system into entities that are, you know, for data versus the ones that are for viewing UI, and controller what sort of connects these. Now there are a lot of frameworks that are just there for you, so you just need to like fill the slots, but I'm a strong believer in getting them to look at getting them to design something from scratch so they can see how they can get a system all connected. And that way they get it, they build an appreciation of all these frameworks, and they'll try to look at, well, how do these work? And that's gonna, in my view, that's gonna make you a better engineer.
And then you can specialize after, like you mentioned, AI VR, AR, whatever. But if you don't have that fundamental, you don't know how it all brings together. Like, it's literally like the sockets, the UBS port. You mentioned the UI and interfacing. You know, like it's incredible the terms that, you know, you just hear bounced around. But if you don't know what that means, how can you add value later as a programmer or come into a company? Wow, that's incredible. So, but let's go back. The origin story, because you went from 40 students to 300, or 40 graduates to 300 graduates. Clearly, there's a linkage to what's happening globally. And when did that shift happen, when you electrical and, you know, it was kind of a thought, it sounds like an add-on department. You know, here we got 40 students, which isn't a lot of numbers. Now you suddenly raised awareness. When did that change, Mohammed? Was it?
I think it's been a bit of a gradual change. I think probably since 2017, 2018.
Yeah.
I think we probably went from 30 to 40 to, you know, 60, 80, and then all of a sudden, you know, it just kind of snowballed from there. And there is definitely a huge need in the industry. And sure. we heard this from different companies that, you know, you guys need to increase your graduates by by X folds or whatever, so we definitely responded to that. But the response has kind of been organic as well. I mean, it's just that the students are coming to software by themselves. So there's just been a lot of interest.
So yeah, there was something that I learned. I think Nusha, one of your students, Nusha was on the podcast. She mentioned that because I was asking, we were kind of talking offline. So if I'm grade 11 or grade 12, my daughter's at grade 11 at Western. She went to Western, so Western Canada High School here. And my question was, so do you just pick software engineering? And maybe you can explain that, because as a grade 11, 12 student, how do I approach that?
Right. So I think knowing what you want to do and trying to sort of choosing what you want to do, it can be pretty challenging.
Yeah.
I mean, the whole cliche story is that people who are excited about becoming a police officer because they think it's really exciting. I mean, how many cop shows do you have running at each time? And then they're realizing that how much paperwork there is, right? Yeah. So I think engaging would be really important. One program that we are running for the last 4 or 5 years at Schulich is our Schulich Ignite program, which is a program that was created, sponsored by Google at first in 2016. It was called Google Ignite, and then we rebranded to Schulich Ignite afterwards. And this is a program that we offer at the University of Calgary, and we have our university students teach programming to our high school students from across Calgary. And throughout the pandemic, we did it all online, and then before, people used to come to campus. And so people can go to schulichignite.com to see to see details. But we try to engage with high schools and try to get students to sort of get a glimpse of what coding and software engineering is all about. Especially for young female students, we're trying to increase diversity in engineering. So we very much would like to present this. The idea of what coding is all about to young female students and see if they're passionate about programming and just engineering in general. But to anybody who has kids in high school or high school students themselves, I think they need to look for opportunities where they can find out more about these disciplines. So one day in the life of a software engineer, what do you do? One day in the life of a civil engineer and so on and so forth. And to try to see what, you know, where does your passion kind of lie?
You know, it's interesting. For me, I think high school is too late for virtually anything. Because, you know, I don't know where that inflection point is when people stop caring to learn. But I do remember grade 9, my daughter, we're going to grade 9. We're driving one morning and I said, here's the ICT course. I was thinking it was an ICT course, grade 9. So, and I'm like, and I said, it'd be a great course to take. Because this is 2019, whatever, a couple of years ago. And I was kind of already into tech and understanding it. And my daughter's like, yeah, I don't know. And then I said, well, you can learn about apps and you can learn all the game, like Fortnite. She was big into Fortnite a couple of years ago. And she says, nah, but it's boring, right? So the mindset was, and I'm not picking on my daughter. I'm picking on that's the challenge you have. If it's all boys or if it's all certain people that have the mindset to code, I'm like, I think that's too late. Grade 9, because they're using the apps or using the fun games and the Instagrams or social medias. But when is that inflection point where you just can lose them, either the well-meaning parents or well-meaning friends? And you know what I mean? Like I think it's too late, high school, personally.
Right. I do agree with you on that. I think that I've seen a lot of, you know, talks by let's say young engineers talking about how they kind of stumble upon engineering and they kind of like it. And I think that it is more challenging for young female students perhaps to kind of find that niche, because You end up, looking at something, and if you have other people to share your interest with, that interest kind of grows. Kind of reminds me where I was. I went to a high school. We do high school visits sometimes. I went to a high school one time in their programming class, and we did a programming workshop. And there was a young lady just sitting by herself, and a whole bunch of boys on the other side. And I was walking around, it just so happened that the young lady was already done the challenge and she was absolutely brilliant. But then, and she was just kind of sitting by herself and like not really doing much or contributing. So that's something that needs to, I completely agree, that's something that needs to change. So Shulik Ignite is attempting to change that. And we've had a lot of good results. We've graduated over 2,000 students. A lot of them have come to Shulik. But more initiatives is required, and just kind of involving people into just STEM in general, science and technology and math in general, but also programming, because this is a huge field, requires a lot of smart people to come in it, and there's room for everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not here for the solutions. I just remember, so I've had a couple of guests. I've had the coding. The ninja coding ninjas on the two Mount Royal students. One's a computer science student, and the other one is a marketing student. So during just kind of COVID-y, they opened up this Code Ninja facility. And she said the biggest change is that's when the students come, they're kind of girls or boys. They're, I don't know, 8, 9 years old, 7, 8, 9 years old, and they're kind of, well, awkward, socially awkward, whatever it is. Afterwards, they light up like a Christmas tree. And the parents are ecstatic how their child has just blossomed. But it's because of that atmosphere at a young age where they're doing things that they share, gaming. If I listen, going back to Reid Hoffman, I'll tell you, I listened to him. He said, coding, when I was playing games, a lot of different games that required me to think. I can't, which War of Worlds or Witchcraft, whatever it is, back in the day, Dungeons and Dragons, those taught me how to think as a coder, as a programmer. And so some of those kids may seem like a socially out of the mainstream, but you get them into where the realm is, it becomes a sort where they're on a Discord together, they're on a chat together, and they look Absolutely. Forward to that social engagement Absolutely. Together with the coding. So the coding is fun then.
Yes, yes. Another, one thing that, I'm a big believer of project-based learning. Right. And for engineers, that should make a lot of sense because that's what essentially we do. We do projects. So learning on the project and learning on a job, it's huge for us. I think project-based learning can really help that, where students can kind of take what they learn from programming and apply it to what they are passionate about and come up with some remarkable applications. I think this generation is a lot more computer savvy by default than, let's say, previous generations, because they grew up with iPads and computers and it's just so natural to them, right?
But they're growing up with the front facing, the UI, the user experience, but the back end, right?
Right, but even that, I think that even that's huge. And what that means is that they're always thinking about, like, what that means is that they use so many IT solutions that it's like, they think of new That's apps young. All the time, right? So they have a lot of good ideas, or they play games and they know exactly, what games they would like to see. So when they do program, and let me tell you this, project-based learning, it's the computing, software engineering, computer science, they're the easiest fields to do project-based learning in. Right, because anything else you wanted to do a project, you wanted to do a project, let's say about in physics, about gravity, about lights. There's all kind of equipment you need. Here you don't need anything; you just need your computer, which everybody sort of has, or you can have. So project-based learning, it allows people to go and work on something that sparks their interest, and that really helps to engage people and bring them out of their shell. And I tell you what, like when I got into software engineering, it was that sense of empowerment that really motivated me to leave the engineering discipline I was in to go in software engineering, because I felt empowered. I felt that I'm sitting behind my computer, I'm creating something. without any other needs. I don't need to buy a kit. I don't need to buy any equipment. I can just sit in my bed, quite frankly, and just create something. And that was a very powerful feeling.
So when I listen to you speak, and I think there's that progression from, you know, undergrad to master's program to PhD, it sounds like your department, and it's not a science lab where, you know, they create something in the lab through chemistry or biology or whatever. But to me, there must be a massive amount of creativity within your department on those projects. And do you have something to share and say, hey, this student came out of, we did this project in year one, and do you have that kind of, that's a lab to me. It's like it's progressive. Absolutely. To something, and you hand it into the Petri dish. It's not a Petri dish. It's a laptop.
Absolutely. So for example, one of the fields that I research exclusively in right now is software engineering training and education. So software engineering practice training and education. And the idea of what is the methodology that you would use to teach so that you still teach the fundamental stuff, but you also teach the applied stuff. And how do you evaluate all of that, right? So, for example, the book that we are authoring with Nusha, The Ignite Project, it's all about that. You know, how do we essentially train people faster and make them more efficient? At the end of the day, we don't want our students to just be experts in a popular framework. For example, React is a very popular one that we teach right now for front-end development. We don't want them just to be gurus of React, and then when React goes away or something else comes, then they're all lost. We want them to really know everything, but then have the ability to go onto these frameworks and libraries and utilize them properly. So we do a lot of research in project-based learning, in hybrid approaches. All these publications are up on my website if anybody's interested. It's a very interesting and engaging research area, which actually has a very high impact.
Huge. I mean, EdTech, you describe, and I think you and I talked about this offline, throwing them in, you know, throwing in into situations. So the fundamental versus the applied. Think of New Zealand All Blacks. What do? They have the four-year-olds throwing the ball around at an early age. And what they do is they let them play. The four-year-olds can play with the 6 and 7-year-olds. They move them up a level higher. So by the time they get to the kids, they live and breathe New Zealand rugby. And their whole program, it's a system to get them to the national level when they're playing globally. And it reminds me a lot during the Soviets, the hockey system, how they used to the kids would start at 5-year-olds together all the way through. But I mean, there's a combination, this you mentioned hybrid, you know, bringing it together from the fundamentals from day one, from 4-year-old. How do you get to how do you play on the World Cup of New Zealand, you know, rugby? How do you become the software engineer that fits today's, you know, that's a methodology that you're describing there that I think they should, EdTech and across the globe should be using something like that. Throw them into the fire.
Yes, yes, yes. And, you know, especially with the right tools, right?
Yeah.
We do all these things. We're really, you know, standing on the shoulder of giants, kind of looking at what other people are doing and kind of learning. And of course, sort of an ongoing process. And Dr. Beruz Farr, who is a professor in our department, I received, he was my graduate supervisor when I was a grad student for my master's and PhD. We were talking about teaching one time and creativity, and he said something quite interesting. He said, well, you know, if you just ask the people who have no background in aerodynamics, be creative and create a plane. Well, maybe they think, you know, what are these wings for? Why can't we just have like a tube that just goes in? You know, if you don't have the background, you can't really be creative. Yeah. Or you can't really anything. Or there is a very a talented professor in our department by the name of Yanni Jazairi. I was talking to him about my object-oriented class years back, and I said, you know, the project-based learning is not really working for me, because I felt like I would define a project, but the students were struggling a lot, and I thought that and I thought, you know, they really should be finding the answers on their own. And Yanni, who is just an incredible teacher, instructor, you know, department, he said, well, you know what, maybe it's not that they're not going to look at the answers. Maybe it's not, it's, they're spinning their wheels too much. Maybe they don't know where to look. And that was such an aha moment. You know, it really transformed the way I think about things, because I started to think about the notion of just-in-time help and making sure that they're not, they're looking at adaptive learning. So they're looking for something, just give them a little nudge, a little help here and there. So they're not completely lost and they're not spending hours and hours looking for something. You give them some direction and soon enough, they're not going to need that much direction, because it's like, you know, human mind is quite...
nudges, you just nudge them in the right direction. As a coach, exactly. You mentioned that sounds like a coach. Hey, absolutely. Why don't you try changing? You know, you think about it. If you think of baseball principles or hockey principles, like just change your grip, change this. What you just did that described there is no different than what coaches do, nudging them absolutely. To the right direction. Try that next time versus just telling them, because they don't see it, but if you just, they might see it through a different lens, right?
Absolutely.
I love that description. So let's go back to the, you know, the engineer student, when he or she comes for year one, they don't automatically go to the software engineering track. Because I know Nusha said she changed. And I think even, you know, Joel Happ on and Luke Halinda, they were, you know, year one is kind of an engineer, general engineering. Is that how it works?
The first year, yes, it's general. So they take about almost a dozen courses that are calculus and math and programming, chemistry, physics, everything. Yes.
So then the science, so they have time to select a computer science, because we're not even talking discipline yet, like AI programming and all that. You're just talking about getting into the software engineering track. Do you pinpoint kids in that first year just because of the, you know, I mean, it's hard. I guess it's hard for you as a professor or some of your professors to who's the right ones to come into the track.
Right. And I remember, so I've been teaching full time at the University of Calgary since 2012.
Yeah.
Now, mind you, at the time I was a grad student, and then I joined as an actual faculty member from 2016. And even back in 2012, you know, I was passionate about software engineering, so I would just motivate my students to come into software engineering. And one of the nicest things that my students, you know, some of my students have told me was that you're the reason we came into software engineering. And I was just, nice. You know, anytime I would hear that, it would just make my day. And hopefully, and I know that if they end up having as much fun as I had in this discipline, that they're just gonna love it and really enjoy that that career. But in first year, and this year was the only year that I didn't teach first year. So I've been teaching first year engineering for 10 years solid. And I always enjoyed it. I enjoyed how students were excited in those classes, and I enjoyed, you know, and I appreciated how much responsibility I have to really introduce them to programming and to software engineering. And I try to really give them a holistic picture, because we have like 900 first year students, 800 to 900. Wow. One thing that I would do, one thing that I would do was I would try to make them understand that programming is important no matter what. So automation and programming, being able to utilize data, being able to write some code to automate some tasks, even if you're not a software engineer, it's going to be a really, really important skill. And that idea became more tangible for students year after year, to now everybody's completely sort of aware of that. I mean, programming is just, you know, computers are everywhere. We're gonna need to communicate.
Well, that's it. Tech is in every discipline. I mean, you talk about you know, the early calculators, the graphic calculators, or what, you know, it's literally, it's everywhere today, more so than when I hear people say, well, there's no incentive to, because we're word of mouth or whatever business it is. We have no intention to go digital, right? And that digital presence could just be a simple thing where you have on Google. Like I remember pre-COVID or just before COVID, I had Jason Ribera on from City of Calgary. He was Calgary Economic Development. He said early COVID, they were working with Google to get businesses registered, you know, a digital presence on a Google search. Yes. When you search, so that search. And then I saw a hack on TikTok or wherever it was that, oh, we can buy that Google domain for $50 and we'll sell it to you for $300. It's kind of like the early days, you know, in the 90s when people were selling the dot coms. I've got the domain name and you want it, you buy it. But that's a digital presence. It's not necessarily tech, but it is tech.
Yeah, right? Yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, for anybody who thinks that their business is not tech related, it's just that they're not realizing yet, you know, it's the story of Blockbuster trying to, you know, saying no to buying Netflix.
Yeah.
It's just a matter of time, right? I mean, a lot of the applications that we're developing in my lab has to do with online education, educational tools. I kind of like the tool that we developed for Ignite. So we developed a tool for Ignite that we can actually send a link to any high school and people can just join a virtual classroom and start programming. That was really important for us. And we actually started that before COVID and it became really, really handy during COVID. Or the article that I pointed out with APEGA, we are working with the Faculty of Nursing and Dr. Linda Duffield-Legere from the Faculty of Nursing, we're building a whole bunch of applications for remote interventions between healthcare professionals and nurses. So a lot of these, there are a lot of applications. There are a lot of things that we can do to work more efficiently and to add value to any trade that you can really think about. Or you know what? Even if it's as simple as just getting some data on your customers and trying to automate that and who buys what when. And just sort of, you know, increase your margins that way. Or there's always some automation and some data analytics that can help everybody.
So I've had a couple good examples. So Cherry Health, I don't know if you know the fellows at Cherry Health. Dr. Max Hirst was on with some of the students and also, Dr. Jordan Volrath. He said, you know, the Facebook groups were so up in the cloud in terms of medical, it's called locum. So the network of getting doctors gigs. They come out of the guy, they graduate, but they're not necessarily going to a hospital. So they want to go on this network. It's called Locum Network, where they can just get gigs with clinics. And he said that it was so disparate, fragmented, these Facebook groups. There's people selling whatever, you know, their local pies versus the doctors didn't have a fulcrum, the locum network of just, this is dedicated just for that. And so Cherry Health is just focused on that. And so it's almost a simple pain problem. The other one is one of your students, Noel Thomas. I don't know if you know Noel, but he was during COVID, his brother slammed his door and his finger in the door. And his first Google was the range. He said the range of that sort of whatever the first, not first responder, but it was from anywhere from amputation all the way up to amputation. So, you know, sutures and things like that up to amputation. He's like, I just wanted something simple for my brother. And so he's focusing on that first, you know, where do you go? Because the Google search today is going to take you a completely different direction. So anyway, I'm just, the abilities are boundless now with the apps you can create. What do you tell those students who want to create some? Do you get students who say, I want to create something. I want to create a better pizza delivery.
Oh, absolutely. Yes. I think that's a great thing for them to do. I run a project course for MEng in software engineering. So our MEng in software engineering is a one-year fast-track master's degree that's offered to both software engineers and non-software engineers. And when non-software engineers take it, they must take a bootcamp semester first. Now, we have a project course, and in that course, I solicit a lot of projects from the industry, and I ask industry companies to really mentor these students. When students come in that course and they say, well, you know what, we want to have our own sort of a startup kind of thing and we want to start that project here in this very course. If there are already software engineers, sometimes I'm a little bit more inclined to say yes, but basically I always try to tell them to try to do a company project first and get some experience. Because when you develop software, you don't know what you don't know. So it's important that you know how to develop software and get that mentorship.
Yeah.
Then the ones that they want to do their own projects, then I ask them to, then you know, I try to find them mentors, and I try to mentor them myself as well. I think it's important to master the trade, right? Like if you're developing a software, making sure you know all the loopholes around security and scalability and maintainability, and just getting feedback on your software development, I think it's really important. But then at the same time, you know, if you do have a good idea and you're passionate about it, it's always good to go and create something. I do, you know, they got people have got to make sure that things actually do make sense, right? I mean, you don't just want to sit and write a whole bunch of spaghetti code because you think this is gonna, you know, go somewhere. You know what I mean? Like there are a few things here, right? Like you got to be creative, of course, but you got to know how to build things right. It's like, you know, for the same reason that you're probably not gonna try to build your own house yourself, right? Like you're gonna get somebody to build it for you, or you're gonna learn first, maybe try and build a couple of houses. The other thing is time is really important for students. They got to manage that time and try to optimize that time. I think a lot of students get into even startups and they end up doing really, really well. I like the students to try to make sure that they, you know, if they work on a startup, they have a good economic plan. Like there's a whole business side to it. It's not just programming. So,
if I take your area of getting to market, say the Ignite program, that's teaching, you know, students, you know, there's a whole movement to retool, reskill, repivot. And so 6 months or to a year, it's a boot camp. 1 year masters. It sounds like, is it non, I want to go with this is that upskilling, reskilling, retooling, because the workforce here, I came back to Calgary 2019, and that was one of the first things I heard is the micro certification programs over at Bow Valley, Calgary Economic Development, trying to repivot people. How do you get them functional taking their, you know, their oil and gas experience or their agriculture experience, whatever it is, where they're no longer employable or employed in the same masses? How do you say, what do you say to those people that 6 to 12 months is a long time, or what do you say?
You mean for the MNG program in general?
Okay, let's go two part question is one, who qualifies for that? Is it only engineers, the MNG, or is it you know what I mean? So, cause like the Master of Management program takes non faculty members and for people in other faculties and brings them into learn about the management skills. But this Master of Engineering, who qualifies for that?
So right now we've had overwhelming demand and it's just open to engineers because in general, you need to have an engineering degree to be able to get a master's in engineering.
Okay.
That's sort of been, you know, when engineers come to that program, you really leverage their training as engineers and their mathematical knowledge and just sort of, these are some of the best classes I ever taught. We had a hackathon for MNG students, and
nice.
This morning they were presenting their results. What we in particular, what we're building is we're building an animal tracking system for the School of Veterinary Medicine at the University of Calgary. Nice. So we got the requirements from them. They came to our class and they sort of talked to the students about it. So building a whole project, and we had a specific feature that was kind of challenging to implement, and we defined that as a hackathon, which is, by the way, what companies do a lot of times when they don't know what to do. They hold a hackathon and everybody goes nuts for like 2 days.
I didn't know that.
But
that sounds, that's an opportunity to work, to pair up, and maybe that's some, down the road, say some of these programs where they are trying to work, retool, repivot people so sit together with your guys, and maybe it's outside program where you just sit and let's brainstorm. I love the veterinary angle, right? Like, what are your problems? What are your pain points? I had on my podcast early COVID, the Calgary, it was the cancer. I can't remember the name of it, but literally they said, well, I said, what's your tech? How much is it? Well, we can't afford to build something, 50, 60,000, whatever it was. I'm like, gosh, there's, you know, to take the 4,000, I got to remember who it was again, but the Wellspring Calgary, they had 4,000 members using their cancer, different stages of cancer. and they have 4,000 members in their group, and they have 90 different projects and helping them, yet they weren't really that tech enabled. You know, the data could tell stories of how people, the recovery, the processes, the information that, you know, the different apps, they could use some tech in them. And I'm not picking on saying tech, but they don't have the money. So exactly. You've got the people, the talent, and the Absolutely. Two together, everyone focuses on profit oriented, but the nonprofits out there, they need it probably more, some of the social welfare, social, you know, mental health, those things. I'm just throwing this out there because a real innovator in my mind is James McCara over at Food Bank. And I've said this many times on this podcast, how he said, you know, we're hiring data analysts, data scientists to help us track data of our guests. I mean, guests being people who use the food bank. Where are they? You know, what's the signaling that's happening in their life? How many often have they been in, and where else are they using? What other social, you know, elements are they using? So they're gone. He's just realized how importance of tech. And I'm not here, but I don't want to put you on the spot, but I think there's so much opportunity to use exactly what you did with that veterinarian, but scale that across and say, hey, how can we give real life, you know, in that either that master's program or the 4-year program?
Yeah, exactly. You know, I completely agree with you. And I think allowing students to really realizing their full potential and sort of being comfortable enough to understand that, hey, we know this.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, it's not that. So for example, allowing them to build that self-confidence to be able to utilize the knowledge that they have learned to sort of real life problems. And then once they do that, they start building that confidence. So anyways, the hackathon was just so such a pleasure to see them. You know, these are people who started a few months back, and now they're building a full stack application. So that's wonderful. That's wonderful to see.
No, you should give me a link to it. If you have that link, the hackathon, I'd love to put that into the episode notes. But let's talk about a couple of things. I know you're on the news, the Calgary Herald, the Global News. Maybe tell a little bit about some of that, because it was an award you got, or just understanding the program.
Right. So there's been a couple of news articles written about the MH program specifically. So I took part in a news story in 2018 for Global News.
Oh, okay.
And we talked about the MNG, and that was the inception of the MNG. It was funny, some of the students only signed up for that program because they saw that news story and that interview. So that was pretty cool. And then Harold did a story on us and how our engineers were getting pretty good jobs right after graduation, and that was awesome. And we feel that this program is going to have a very positive impact in Calgary because of all the engineers that are also getting software engineering.
That is huge, right? You mentioned the only reason he got it because they saw the article. So that awareness, I think, Mohammed, I think there's a huge opportunity, you know, to get that, you know, for you've got 300 students a year. I don't know how many, if you times 12 or times 10, how many years it's been, or four, three, you know what I mean? Each time that multiplies, so this where are they now kind of story, you know, that would be a great series
for
reflecting
sure.
back.
Absolutely, you know, yes, that's a great idea. It's been pretty much the whole MNH program has been probably amongst the most satisfying works that I've done professionally anywhere in a company, research, teaching, anything. And I did receive the 2021 D12 Innovation Award from the Society of Higher Society for Teaching and Learning in Higher Education. So this was a national award for Canada that I received for the creation of this program, and it's just been such a rewarding experience.
I mean, I'm going to talk about the detail in a second, but I mean, to me, it sounds like there's almost a franchising or a template of for some of the smaller universities or learning institutions across the globe. Because I mean, EdTech, as you know, and I can think of a couple of them in India, like Bijus or Bijus Education, because you have such a mass population. EdTech is, you know, and there was also a knock, I think, in India and in China recently, you probably heard, where they just pulled back and said, you're going from a profit to a nonprofit, or, you know, so the EdTech revolution is global. But when there's disruptions like that, I think there's a template whatever the innovation, whatever detail selected you for that innovation, that there, here's a small little, you, if I had 6 months, if I had 12 months, I had 4, you know what I mean? Like there's a little bit of, you know, little learning tools and little templates you could give to people. Do you share that with other institutions now that you're getting national recognition?
Well, yes. So what I do as part of this, I would share. So a couple of things. I've published a couple of papers about this, which we presented at the Canadian Engineering Education Association Conference. And also we published a paper on the bootcamp semester and how we balance the material. I shared sort of the details of the program when I received the award. And then I'm supposed to go to Ottawa this summer to actually to participate in the ceremony, because this year we didn't have it because of COVID. So we would share it there. So yes, we publish on the results of this program which is a student surveys, and we take surveys from the students, different types of surveys to see how they're doing, and just analyzing those results, because you don't want to pack too much, but you don't want to pack too little. And then if you look at the whole taxonomy of software engineering, it becomes like Sophie's choice. You know, what to choose to put in and what not to put in. And that's challenging.
But, you know, so could you take me, just listening to you speak, and it's just incredible. It takes me to, there was a TED talk I listened to recently, or maybe last year, but it's the chemistry. He was talking about chemistry, biology. He goes, God, I'm really struggling to learn this. And his dad was a professor, I think in somewhere in Eastern Canada. And he said, my dad, you know, I went to him and I went to YouTube. This was, I think it was 10 years ago. I said, just went to YouTube to learn this method or to teach. I can't remember what it was. He said, Dad, he went to his dad. He was excited about this new, there's no way you're putting my lectures online and social media and all that. But he said, because that, not, he thought his dad would be excited to, I wish I could get you that link to that. But he said, I put it online and just teaching people the basics, because to share his passion, his dad's passion for chemistry, maybe it's biology. I might miss the thing, but I mean, your passion of teaching and taking that, you share that. I don't know how you, to get more people out there. And it's, I know it's hard. You said like Sophie's choice. If you give them too much, then they're not going to do anything. If you don't give them enough, they won't be exciting enough. How do you balance that? I mean, again, that tenure of a seasoned tenure of a professor and his son who wanted to put it online. How do you balance that?
No, I think, you know, so software engineers are practitioners, you know, like we, at the end of the day, we don't just design something and then other people would build it. We actually do the whole thing. We design, we develop, we build, we manage, all of that. And obviously it's too many things to learn and too many things to know for any one person. I mean, there are geniuses amongst us, but there's a whole bunch of things. And to decide what to include in a program, even if it's a 4-year program, it's still challenging, because let's say if you're talking about AI, you're not talking about, you know, virtual reality. If you're talking about virtual reality, you're not talking about, let's say, security. And there's just so much, and you can go in depth into everything.
Yeah.
You can't go in depth into everything. That's the reality of the situation. But one thing that's really important for students to know is that, as a practitioner, you must be able to execute, and you must be able to do things and to build things. And if you don't, then you'd have to change your career, essentially. So it's important for people to learn the fundamentals, and then learning how to learn, right? Learning how to learn. Okay, new platform, sure, let's go. What's different? What's different here? Let's learn that. Let's go. And you know, you don't want to overburden your students, but then at the same time, you're doing it a disservice if you don't talk about certain things. And that's when it becomes, you know, Sophie's choice. But what I do is that I make a point. I almost have like a full lecture at the end of the program or at the end of the semester, where I tell students, what is it that we didn't cover and what is it that they should go do now? So, you know, we've done a whole bunch of things and there's a whole bunch of things left. And the students who really sort of get that and understand that technology is ever changing, you understand the fundamentals, great. You need to just build on them, they're the ones who have a great career in tech.
The learn to learn. It sounds like to me you would subscribe to. I listened to a podcast yesterday. In fact, he said, I didn't know any 9 months ago. I know nothing about NFTs. I'm not going to go into NFTs. But he said, but I learned enough. I did the 50 hours, and I'm going back to I did my 50 hours of blockchain. And when I learned about blockchain in 2017, 18, Stanford, Harvard, Oxford were charging $5,000 for an introduction to blockchain, 6-week course. And I'm giving the example. The reason being I'm saying is I'm not saying I was a guru, but I looked at the curriculum and I looked at what I was learning online for free through white papers and through podcasts about blockchain. I probably spent the 50 hours. My point being is I think to learn what, you know, people reject it because if they haven't spent the time, they reject, oh, you can't use this. And the genesis of yesterday's podcast was he said, look, spend the 50 hours to learn. And then you have the right to reject. So I, you know, the Sophie's choice. Yes, there's a whole, but people say I reject the whole entire thing without learning one aspect, learning to learn. Because if you reject it without knowing, you're just a disservice. So the student, I don't know. It's more of I love the learning to learn because I think you're on that. Learn the fundamentals. Before you reject the fundamentals, learn it, and then you can make the decision whether you go to the next level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, yes. And, you know, you get to a point where to form your own opinion, basically, right? But you got to put in the work and understand, you know, kind of like, you know, if you have a strong background, like let's say in finances, right? And if you have a strong background in math, then if you're trying to understand, let's say DeFi, that makes things easier. But let's say if you have no idea how finances work and you don't know math, and then there's just no hope, right? I mean, it's just
well, it's a lot harder. It's a harder slog because you're trying to find a solution to something that you don't fundamentally understand the problem.
Exactly.
Back to your but let's go to DTL because DTL, as I know, they use it here in most of the high schools in Calgary. My daughter, I get a DTL message every week. How did you? Was it something that they found out about you? Was it because they saw you in the Herald, the DTL Award?
And no, so DTL Award, so it's an award. I think they're sponsoring the award from the Society for Teaching and Learning in Higher Education. So Society of Higher Learning Education, Higher Learning in Higher Education, they essentially take applications from all universities. So your university, each university in Canada nominates one person for the award, and then the society has a committee, and as a committee they sit and they pick a handful of award winners based on the people who have been nominated. And I believe that D2L is sponsoring this particular award, and that's why it's named after them.
Well, and the only reason that I wanted to keep on DTL because they recently, because I knew that my daughter gets, I get emails from that, and my daughter uses DTL, but they also listed on a public exchange, an IPO, on Toronto Venture Exchange back in November, and which I'm sure you're familiar with. So, you know, they're very successful. I have no idea other than a management education tracking system, but what have they done that's innovative that you could describe? Because I don't know.
Right. I mean, D2L is a learning management system, and there's certainly a lot of different learning management systems that are out there. So essentially a learning management system can go it can have a lot of they can have a lot of features they're basically the medium between students and faculty or teachers or professors or whatever, right?
Yeah.
So I think, as I said, there are a lot of applications who basically do the same thing. To call a learning management system innovative, they have to enrich that communication, right, between
students and the teachers. It's a platform, right? It's a platform to allow students to communicate with the teachers and teachers to communicate with their. It sounds like to me that signal tells me that they have the community. They have a real community and users, and they're engaging. You know, that whether it's innovative or not, they probably disrupted somewhere along the way to adopt from the old to old to new. So, well, look,
absolutely. It's a feature-rich platform. Right now for COVID, we ended up doing our quizzes, for example, on D2L and all that. But it's definitely but as you said, you got to look at what else can be done to really enrich the communication between teacher, educators, and students.
Well, I could go along with different ways in this one, but I'll leave on one thought. It was Dr. Ian Holloway. He's a faculty of law. Mm-hmm. He was an early COVID guest on my podcast. And he was saying COVID hit. And within 3 days we went online. He said they had some innovation anyway, they were ready. He said, but I had professors who basically were old school PDF and exams and everything. And he said, they got thrown off the cliff. And before they fell down, they had to have all their exams before they hit the CE or whatever, something like that, that they had to have everything online. So it was that quick for some of those old school professors. I mean, to you, you're around that all the time. But do you see that? Do you get more non-computer science or Dr. Ian Holloway, their group is a bit of innovative, but do you get other professors coming across and say, can you help us? You know what I mean?
A little bit. I used to do flipped learning. So for example, the first year class that I told you about, since 2015, I've been doing online learning with them, but that wasn't really on live classrooms. It was I would record videos and I would post the videos for them to watch and then do quizzes on them and then come to the lab where we would actually interact with them. So I used to do a lot of online learning for a number of years. So when this started, I was one of the typical sort of suspects that worked to help other faculty members get simulated with online learning. But that everybody just got used to it really fast. We just started to power through it.
I just think there's a huge opportunity. I can go number threads on this one, but we're gonna start. You're natural already, it sounds like, for online or YouTube, whatever it is. Shulik Shoes. We're gonna do walk a mile. She mentioned a day in engineer, whatever it is. Shulik Shoes, walk a day in my shoes. Episode one, Shulik Shoes. We're gonna do this. I literally think there's so many opportunities, but probably the easiest one is bring back some students from Shulik Shoes, right? You wore some Shulik Shoes in a day. How big were they, right? And you went from a size 12 to a size 9 because you've downgraded. You know what? I'd love that. I think that's something you and I can talk offline. I think it's awesome. But how do students find you? Because it was tough to find you. You were hidden, amongst the faculty. I got referred. But how do people find you and how do they learn more about your programs?
Right. So I have my website is probably the best way, moshefood.com. I'm also on LinkedIn if anybody wants to message me, but my email address is on my website. If you go to moshepur.com, you can sort of read all about my research activities and my teaching and the team. I also post my recent publications and any articles that is published about us. So I'll be posting this podcast on there too.
Well, Mohammed, this has been fun. There's so much. It's packed. It's a full stack. Talking to you is a full stack. We can go front end. I don't know what we covered today. If we covered everything, if I haven't covered all your questions, please feel free to share one last thought. Because if I haven't covered everything,
this has been great. Absolutely. Thank you so much for talking to me. We'll chat again soon, I'm sure.
Have a safe day. Have a great. It's not a bad day today here in Calgary. So have a great day.
All right, take care. You too. Bye-bye.
Yeah, bye-bye.